I thought it was funny the other night when Michael said, "This is a session, not a weekend workshop." When I was young, my Catholic friends would sometimes go on a retreat, and I thought, "Boy, that is weird. What is a retreat anyway? What are they doing?" They could never really explain. And now it seems like everybody is constantly going on retreats of one sort or another. Business groups, you know, have retreats to talk about business things, all kinds of retreats. But I still don't understand why anybody would go on a retreat or what a retreat is. I guess Michael was implying that you go on a retreat to get something that you didn't have before the retreat, some skills or improved thoughts or something. And he was contrasting that with session, which is useless. Because you don't expect really to get anything out of it. Which I can understand better than retreats. I don't understand retreats, but I can understand uselessness very well. And he explained, and I thought it was really wonderful, the idea that session literally means to touch the mind, to touch the heart. So it's not self-help. Also, when I was young, there was no self-help. It's a later invention. I guess in those days, nobody thought they needed any help. But now, everybody knows that they need help, some kind of help. So yes, we should help ourselves if possible. And if possible, we could get other people to help us. So we have self-help and other help. We should get other people to help us, and we should help them too. So I guess it would not be incorrect to say that Zen practice is self-help and other help practice. Because practice does help us. I think truly we all already know this, probably, or we wouldn't be here. And we all also know that when we practice together in a sangha, the sangha helps us. And we help the sangha. Sometimes the help that we receive might not look like help, or maybe it isn't the help that we thought we wanted, but simply to practice side by side, to share the same life and the same dedication together is a big support, a big, big help. Probably, in the end, it's the best kind of help. Maybe also, Michael meant that when we touch the mind together in session, we realize that actually we don't need help because we don't need to fix ourselves. We're actually all right as we are, even with all our troubles and messes. And when we can deeply and fully appreciate what and who we are, we can have a lot of patience and forgiveness with ourselves. And when we can have a lot of patience and forgiveness with ourselves, then we can have patience and forgiveness with others too. And I think that in the end, the most lofty truths of Buddha Dharma just come down to that. That we can have patience and forgiveness with ourselves and others. And we can really appreciate the nobility, the beauty of our own struggles and the struggles of others. And that we can begin to actually see ourselves and everyone else with eyes of compassion. As we know, it's a rough world sometimes. And there are a lot of good reasons to mistrust others and the world itself, and maybe even ourselves. But the practice will eventually give us a trusting heart, despite everything. So, as I was saying to someone, or maybe I said it in one of the talks yesterday or the day before, or possibly I said it in some other talk in some other place where I was and forgot about. Or maybe I never said it before. I don't know. Maybe I just thought it. But anyway, whatever. With all this research they have now about meditation, we could think of meditation now as good psychological hygiene practice, which is true. I have a friend, an old friend, meaning I know him a long time, also he's old, Les Kay, who's a Zen teacher from Silicon Valley. And Les Kay always says, you should practice Zazen every day just like brushing your teeth. Just do it. You know, it's no big deal. And you better do it, because if you don't do it, eventually your teeth will fall out. And then my friend Meng from Google, he proudly says he was employee 100 at Google. He was one of my partners in creating the famous Google meditation course called Search Inside Yourself. And in those days, Meng would always say, we have to scale meditation up. We have to scale it up. And he would say, I think that meditation should be just like going to the gym someday. You know, there are lots of meditation halls everywhere in every neighborhood, and you either go there or you feel properly guilty that you don't. Just like the gym. You know, you either go or you feel guilty that you don't go. Well, this has actually more or less happened in the intervening years. I don't know how many years ago it was that we were doing that, but in those years, this has almost happened. There's a lot of meditation everywhere you go. And in the Buddhist sanghas, we emphasize, of course we do, meditation. You would think that Buddhism was more or less a particular form of meditation, and that's all. But that is not actually the case. The Buddha did, of course, speak about meditation practice, and he thought it was important, but he did not see meditation practice as a standalone route to awakening. For the Buddha, meditation was an important part of a culture of awakening that included many, many elements besides meditation. Sangha relations, teachers, chanting, bowing, devotional incense offering, ethical development, precepts, commitment ceremonies, wearing robes, it's a big practice in Buddha Dharma, wearing robes, sutra study, and many other things. And for us, in our particular Dharma family, the culture of awakening includes, importantly, Oryoki practice. And I'm aware of how hard it is to do Oryoki practice, how much it involves. So I'm really grateful that Mountain Rain can maintain, at least for the time being, this wonderful practice. Culture of Buddha Dharma includes also Sesshin practice, the sound of the bell, the sound of the han, the clackers, serving meals, receiving tea. All of this is a culture of awakening. And I think Michael referred to this too, that our practice is a whole world. And certainly this world is pervaded by the spirit of meditation practice, because this Buddha Dharma culture is founded on silence, on peacefulness, on equanimity. So the culture of meditation pervades the culture of Dharma, but the culture of Dharma also pervades meditation. Because meditation is a subjective art. It's not an objective science. So the way we think of our meditation practice, the way we feel about and in our meditation practice, influences how we practice our meditation. And it influences the effects that the meditation has on our lives. It is certainly possible to practice meditation as a way of intoxicating yourself. It's possible to practice meditation as a way of avoiding yourself and your human pain. This is definitely possible. You could meditate to produce an artificial peace. You could meditate because it might be better than watching Netflix. You know, it gives you a break from your life. So all those things are possible. And I think many people who do meditation do it for one of those various reasons. But when you practice Zazen in the context of a culture of Buddha Dharma, which includes teachings and all the trappings. What a great word, trappings, right? We get trapped. Too bad. We're trapped in our practice. When you practice Zazen in the context of all the trappings of practice and of this great culture of Buddha Dharma, then the Zazen practice has a different meaning and a different purpose. We hold it differently and we live it differently. So as I said, Sesshin is a very big part of our Dogen Zen Dharma Buddha Dharma culture. And part of Sesshin is what we're doing right now, Dharma talk. I always say it's in the schedule, so we have to do it. It's really the same as everything else. It's just in the schedule. So every day I come in here and I try to say something to you. And even though I'm talking and you seem to be passively listening, I know that that is not actually the case. What I am saying comes from the Dharma. It comes from my teachers. It comes from my own experience, and it also comes from you. And what you are hearing, which might not have all that much to do with what I'm saying, and I know each one of you is hearing a different talk, what you're hearing also comes from the Dharma in you and from the conditioning in your life. When I'm talking in Sesshin, I'm actually talking to you. I'm not giving a generic talk that I would give anywhere. I'm talking to you, not somebody else. And I am saying what I'm feeling is coming from you, because the Dharma is already in you, and it wants to find a voice. And when you listen, I know that you are actively listening. You are taking the words to heart. Maybe only one or two words go in, maybe as many as three or four. and you'll find your own meaning, or the meaning that you need for now. And I don't expect anybody to remember anything I say. That is not the point at all. Because you're listening not so much with your mind, with your memory. You're listening with the pores of your skin. You're listening not only with your eardrums, but also with your earlobes. You're listening with your eyes. You're listening with your breath. Possibly you think you understand what I'm saying. Maybe you think you don't understand, but it doesn't matter one way or the other, because my talk isn't in the words. It's between the words, underneath the words. And that part you always perfectly hear. And my talk isn't a self-help talk. Nothing that I say will help you. And I'm not giving advice. Maybe once in a while, a little tidbit of advice, like Michael gave us pretty good advice the other night when he said, there's two ways to do Sesshin, you choose. That was pretty good advice, I thought. But mostly, no, not too much advice. What I'm trying to do is participate with you. You in your position, me in mine, to participate with you in living and creating this great, noble culture we call Buddhist practice, a culture of benevolence and peacefulness, a culture of joy and compassion. Those words I just rattled off, preachers always have those words, you know. They seem so quaint and old-fashioned, benevolence, compassion, love, peacefulness. Do they even mean anything? And yet we're breathing, literally breathing, meaning into these ancient words together through our shared practice. And little by little by little, as time goes by and the whole world changes and we change, we are absorbing this culture and it is influencing us and we are influencing it. The boat pulls us along and we sail the boat. And it takes every voice to sing the song. So, thinking of all this, because here we are studying Dogen at least a little bit this week, what are we trying to do when we're studying Dogen? And isn't it amazing? I mean, we take it for granted, but isn't it amazing that we can actually read the words and somehow make sense of the words of a 13th century Japanese Zen priest whose entire worldview and culture and language is so radically different from ours. Thanks to the many translators and the faithful students of Dogen over the many generations for this. And of course, we know we're misunderstanding Dogen. How could we not be? For a long time in Japan, people just assumed that Dogen's words were far too lofty for anyone to understand. So hundreds of years went by and nobody studied Dogen. They kind of venerated the book, literally the book, venerated it, offered incense to it. They venerated Dogen as a great teacher, but nobody read his teachings. It's hard to believe, you know, but that's true. Sometime in the 17th or 18th century, I forget when exactly, some Soto Zen priests began this revolutionary thing to actually read Dogen and see what he said and try to understand. And they began to reform the Soto Zen tradition based on their study of Dogen's writings. And then, astonishingly enough, in the 20th century, when the Japanese became aware of and threw themselves into the Western culture, they realized that when you looked at Dogen through Western eyes, Dogen seemed oddly contemporary. So then they started translating Dogen into Western languages. And then Dogen became interpreted in many, many ways. So the history of the reception of Dogen's writings is truly strange over these last hundreds of years. And not only that, but Dogen is also credited with inventing the tradition of Japanese prose writing. Because before Dogen, all important writing in Japan was done in Chinese. Just like in Europe, all important writing, serious writing, was done in Latin. There were no traditions of colloquial written languages. But Dogen, who wrote in Chinese often, wrote Shobogenzo, his great work, in Japanese. So he sort of invented writing Japanese prose. And it's really impossible now, especially given that, to understand what Dogen actually had in mind, not only because even contemporary Japanese speakers don't understand medieval Japanese, but also we don't understand the context, the situation out of which he spoke. You know, just like I'm speaking to you, he was speaking to people in his time. And not understanding their conditions, it's hard to understand why Dogen said what he said and what he meant by it. So to me, it's absolutely marvelous that even though there is no way we could understand Dogen, still, it's marvelous that we can find in his words a coherent and powerful way to practice that is proven to be valuable and true. It is marvelous that somehow we can squint through the swirling mists of smoky history and culture and find such a startling, bracing, and inspiring truth. It's a kind of miracle to me. Really, it's a kind of miracle. And studying Dogen is an important element in the tapestry of our practice. There are some Soto Zen priests who only study Dogen. Their main practice is studying Dogen. And they don't study anything else in Dharma but Dogen. In our Dharma family, we study Dogen, but we study lots of other things too, because I think that we couldn't understand Dogen unless we study other things too. But Dogen study is our heart and our guide in studying whatever else we study. And what are we doing when we're studying a religious text anyway? It's not the kind of study that we've all been brought up with. It's a very different thing. Maybe it's even wrong to use the word study. Maybe we should say we don't study Dogen text. We practice Dogen text. We read or we listen with an open heart. We take the words, like we say, to heart. And we try to receive them not only with our mind, with our intelligence, but also with our emotions and our body. And once in a while, something goes in. And we can cherish those words as an experience that lasts a whole lifetime. There are phrases in Dogen that, for me, are inexhaustible treasures of a lifetime. The sixth, the Zen ancestor, Huineng, famously heard one line from the Diamond Sutra, a line that says something like, give rise to a mind unsupported anywhere, unsupported by sights, sounds, smells, tastes, or touchables. He heard that one line, and it changed his life forever, and it changed our lives too. So we practice Dharma in this way, integrating thinking, feeling, and sudden opening spiritual insight into one delightful, seamless practice. And once you get involved in studying the Buddha Dharma, it's a humbling experience. It's huge, it's vast. Probably I told you that when we were in Korea a couple of years ago, we were able to go to Haeyansa, a mountain monastery which has the oldest existing woodblock print collection of the entire Tripitaka, stored in this giant building in Haeyansa. And I'll never forget, they opened the door for us and we walked into this room, and my wife Kathy, probably on my behalf, on all of our behalfs, just spontaneously burst into tears. She burst into tears just to behold, here it is, the whole of the written Dharma in its most ancient form. You could study Dharma easily for the rest of your life. Drop everything else you're doing all day long and do nothing but study the Dharma every day, and you'd not even come close to touching what's there. And the huge majority of it has not been translated into Western languages and maybe never will be. So it's an immense thing. In his introduction to the Thomas Cleary translation of the Wycliffe Record, Maizumi Roshi writes, there are numerous ways to read a book: skimming, memorizing, careful study, quiet reading, reading aloud, reading with the body, reading with the mind, and reality reading. It is this last kind of reading which the Wycliffe Record, and I would say all spiritual text, requires. In this mode, you yourself become the text. And in so doing, the Wycliffe of ancient China stands revealed to you as your very life, right here in this time and place. So really, the whole of the Buddha Dharma is really a memoir, right, of your life. The facts of your life are actually kind of incidental. The memoir of your life is found in Dogen and everywhere in the Buddha Dharma. And you read it with that feeling, this is my life. This is my story. So with all that, let's finish today, I hope, reading Zenki, because we didn't finish yesterday. We still have more, still have more to go. So yesterday we left off with the wonderful metaphor of the boat. You remember, I'll read for you again what Dogen has to say about that. Birth is just like riding in a boat. You raise the sails and you steer. Although you maneuver the sail and the pole, the boat gives you a ride. And without the boat, you can't ride. But you ride in the boat, and your riding makes the boat what it is. Investigate a moment such as this. at just that moment, there is nothing but the world of the boat. The sky, the water, and the shore are all the boat's world, which is not the same as the world that is not the boat's. Thus, you make life what it is. You make life your life. When you ride in a boat, your body, mind, and environs together are the undivided activity of the boat. The entire earth and the entire sky are both the undivided activity of the boat. Thus, life is nothing but you, and you are nothing but life. So this is a koan that you can practice for the rest of your time on earth. Life is nothing but you. You are nothing but life. Who could ever come to the end of appreciating that? So next, Dogen quotes a saying that probably was the germ for this whole fascicle. He's quoting Master Yuan Wu, who said, "Life is undivided activity, death is undivided activity." Clarify and investigate these words. And what you should investigate is this. While the undivided activity of birth has no beginning or end and covers the entire earth and the entire sky, it hinders neither birth's undivided activity nor death's undivided activity. At the moment of death's undivided activity, while it covers the entire earth and the entire sky, it hinders neither death's undivided activity nor birth's undivided activity. This being so, birth does not hinder death. Death does not hinder birth. So there are many things we could say about this passage, but here's one. If you think about what Dogen is saying, you could think, what a madman. You know, this is so egotistical, so solipsistic. If we really take this to heart and believe Dogen when he says, life is nothing but you, if we practice undivided activity, as we were saying the other day, as if we are actually in the center of the universe, as though what you are doing right now covers heaven and earth, and there's nothing more important, nothing more significant on earth and in the heavens than your life right now, in this moment. And that is how we understand it. Well, isn't that being a little presumptuous? Isn't that a little crazy that you're supposed to like think that? We can think of many spectacular egotists in our world of the present and in the past who might have looked at their lives in that way. Those are not people we think are great people, you know. We think they're madmen, you know, somehow. And if we think that our undivided activity right here and right now is so important, then how can we at the same time acknowledge the radical vulnerability of our lives, that we can be blown away in an instant? Don't you have to pretend that that's not so in order to feel the full power of your life? How is Dogen suggesting here that we are like ultimately arrogant and ultimately humble at the same time? But that seems to be the implication. So Dogen is saying that there is a fundamental difference between our completely honoring our life's power and the centrality of our own life for the universe. There's a big difference between that and ordinary human arrogance. My undivided activity in this precious moment of a human lifetime is eternal and absolutely unstoppable. I think a lot of us feel, you know, disempowered in this crazy world. What can we do to change things? Dogen is saying, every moment you are the boss. You can change the world on every moment. And yet this moment of your supreme power, he says, doesn't hinder your vulnerability, your impermanence, your death. That's embedded right in the middle of it. Zenki not only takes death into account, Zenki is permeated with death and impermanence at every point. Also, he's saying, my undivided and all-encompassing activity, which leaves absolutely nothing out, does not hinder your undivided and all-encompassing activity. Your activity and all activity throughout space and time is embedded in mine, just as mine is embedded in yours. One reality at every point, simultaneously in space and time. He goes on, both the entire earth and the entire sky appear in birth as well as in death. However, it is not that one and the same entire earth and sky are fully manifested in birth and in death, although not one, not different. Although not different, not the same. Although not the same, not many. So when we hear this teaching of Dogen right away, we want to understand it. And we want to know it as an idea, as a concept. So we say profound things like one reality in simultaneous space and time. But no, not really. Any idea that we might have will always be just an idea conditioned by our smallness, because our mind and our concepts will always be misleading. So it's not a matter of having the right idea. It's just a matter of remembering that we will always have the wrong idea. That's important, that we remember that. Because when we know that we're always going to have the wrong idea, we can be humble about it. You know, we can say we have this idea and that idea. Good. We can be open to all our ideas and all other ideas. We can be open to all views. We can live with some ease in the midst of them, guided by the Dharma. Similarly, he says, in birth, there is the undivided activity of all things, and in death, there is the undivided activity of all things. There is undivided activity in what is not birth and not death. There is birth and there is death in undivided activity. This being so, the undivided activity of birth and death is like a young person bending and stretching. Or it's like someone asleep at night searching for the pillow. This is realization in vast, wondrous light. So, even though we can never quite get this and never conceptualize it, we can live it. That's the beauty. We don't have to understand it, because it's better, you know, that we can't understand it, because that makes it possible for us to actually live it And in fact, we are living it. And we have been living it all along. And it's wonderful, I think, that Dogen uses such homey metaphors to describe it. Maybe actually they're not metaphors. Maybe he means it literally. Watch a young person. If you want to see what Zenki looks like, actually see it with your eyes. Look at a young person bending and stretching. Maybe a child especially, bending and stretching. When you get a little old and creaky, and bending and stretching is a little bit of a project, you can really appreciate how great it is to be young and to be able to bend and stretch in any direction you want, and you don't even have to think about it. You don't have to, like, figure out how to do it. You just do it. I now have achieved the state where I have to think about whether or not it's worth it to bend over and pick up that thing that I dropped. Because to bend over and pick it up is a thing. It's a serious activity. And maybe it's not worth it. Maybe I'll just leave it there. So there's two things that are there bending over that I have to pick up, and I can get them both. But if you're young, you know, you don't think like that. You don't even think about it. You just, your body just can do that. Or just sometime watch somebody sleeping, and they turn over in their sleep and they reach back for their pillow. It's such a natural and easy thing. There's no calculation there, right? There's no conceptualization. There's no ego, right? There's no, I want something out of this. There's just a natural thing of reaching back, moment by moment, beautiful, natural, spontaneous movement. That's what Zenki looks like. And while I'm thinking about it, sleeping is great, right? Do you like to sleep? I think it's the greatest thing. To lie down, right, and go to sleep after a long day of sitting or maybe working, and you're tired out and you're ready to go to sleep, this is great. This may be the ultimate form of undivided activity. Really, this might be like the best of all Buddhist practices, going to sleep at night. To really be able and ready at the end of the day to sleep, having done what needed to be done that day, right? And now you're tired out and you're ready to completely let go and rest, which doesn't happen at the end of every day necessarily, right? But when it does, this is really the practice of undivided activity, and it's the greatest of all. Also, wouldn't it be nice, the last time you're sleeping at the end of your life, to be able to lie down like that? Wouldn't that be great? So I hope all of you are enjoying your sleep this week. I know some of you are sleeping even in Zazen. Which is also quite wonderful, too, in its own way. Although painful because you keep trying to wake up, you know. But if you just slept in Zazen, it would be great. And probably you all know that when Dogen uses this particular image of a person reaching back for a pillow in the night, he's referring, as he almost always is, this is one reason why it's hard to understand Dogen, because almost nothing he says is not referring to something else. And you probably don't know what it is. But in this case, we do know what it is. He's referring to another Zen story that is dear to our hearts, in which reaching back for your pillow in the night is an image that stands for compassion. Natural, easygoing compassion. So although in this fascicle Dogen is not talking about it, when he uses this image, he's giving us a signal that Zenki is at its heart compassion. That undivided activity is at its heart the practice of loving and caring. And this is how we do things in our practice. It's one of the great things, actually, about Zen and all of Far East Asian Buddhism, which has this more than Buddhisms that come from India, the idea that each and everything is alive and deserves our care, not only sentient beings, but all beings. So this is how we are instructed in our practice, to do everything with loving care. Caring with love for the pots and pans, for the zafu. Well, why do we bow to our zafu? Because we honor this cushion and this spot on earth with love and care. The teacup, precious teacup. So inanimate things we care about, we care for. Of course we care for other people and animals and plants and for ourselves. And Dogen says this is called undivided everyday activity. It's called realization in vast, wondrous light. So the last paragraph of the text. At just such a moment, you may suppose that because realization is manifested in undivided activity, there was no realization prior to this. However, prior to this realization, undivided activity was already manifested. The undivided activity manifested previously does not hinder the present realization of undivided activity. Thus, your understanding can be manifested moment after moment. So, we don't have to laboriously produce undivided activity, sweating and straining the entire time. It's already there. It's the way things have always been, in fact. It's as if reality loves us and has been patiently waiting for us to care for it the whole time, even when we didn't realize it. When you practice undivided activity on that moment, it's as if, despite what I just said and what Dogen said, it's as if undivided activity never existed before and depended on your arising it. You have discovered it for the first time. And each time, moment after moment, you discover it again for the first time, not only for yourself, but for all of us. Because it's been waiting for you to discover it the whole time. So that's the end. Finally, we did it. It only took us 5 hours or however many hours to read Dogen's great text, Zenki, a text which he presented to the assembly of monks, nuns, and lay people and officials at the residence of the former governor of Izumo province near Roku Haramitsu Temple in Kyoto on the 17th day of the 12th month of the third era of the third year of the Ninji era, which in our calendar is the year 1242. So that's when he presented this text to those people. And how wonderful that on this 13th day of the 11th month of the 2018th year of the Western era, nearly 800 years later, we can appreciate and practice these words. So, thank you for listening, and let us continue to do just that. May our intentions equally